Okay, why don't we proceed to the panel here? Can I invite all the speakers and two other additional participants, Ms. Landau and Dr. McCoy? Is Denise?
She's getting wired.
Oh, okay. Please sit down. Please sit down. Okay. Please. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for those very interesting intervention. Very informative and at times quite controversial. Before I open the floor for some Q&A and more observation and discussion, let me invite two other speakers who are on the panelists. I'll start with Ms. Denise Landau, former Executive Director of the International Association of Antarctica Tour Operators from the U.S., and we have heard several times tourism being mentioned by the speakers. Denise, you have the floor.
Thank you, and is it working?
Mike? Yeah. Yes, sir.
It's a pleasure to be here, and I didn't actually imagine that I'd be sitting here in Washington, D.C. on December 1st, 2009, celebrating what I think has been a fantastic 50 years of the Antarctic Treaty System. And so it's a privilege to be here with everybody, and I'd like to particularly thank Paul and the organizing committee for having us all here and sharing the day with us today. So thank you all. And this meeting's been very productive. Tourism, I'll just be very brief, although I have pages of information that I'd like to talk about. For anybody that knows me knows I probably could go on for a few hours. But this particular session is all about international cooperation. And tourism in the Antarctic is all about international cooperation. It's the tour companies from 15 different countries interacting amongst each other. Each of the tour companies have ships or they have airplanes. Their passengers, their staff, or their crew come from all over the world. The airplanes, the same. Each of the companies interact with their governments. The tourists come from all over the world. So it's really the epitome of what international cooperation is. As well, each of the tour operators, at some point or another over their years of operation, work closely with scientists. The scientists are transported down to the ice on either ships or airplanes. And the cooperation of the tour operators to support science is very strong, and it's a mission of the tour operators. And so it's appropriate that this particular session about international cooperation would include tourism. Over the last 40 years of tourism being, or commercial tourism being active, we've seen numbers of changes in the industry. Everyone's seen that chart or the graph that has grown dramatically. The tourism numbers have grown, you know, 400-500% over the last 15, 20 years. Currently, the trend is a downward trend, actually, and partly it's due to the economics of the world. In part, it's due now to the non-availability of small ships. One of the more interesting changes of numbers that if any of you had read some of the recent IATA reports to the ATCM, that the numbers of large ship passengers, ships carrying over 500 passengers, are almost equal to the small ship passengers, and that's the first time that's ever happened in 40 years. And it's for those of you who are worried about large ships, it's a pretty scary number. And so I think for the future, there are quite a few challenges that the ATCM has, that the tour operators have, that the scientific community has in working together to make sure that scientists can still be transported, that the ATCM can regulate tourism, and that the tour operators can do the best job they can in continuing to develop best practices. And having been involved with IATA for 20 years, executive director for 9, it was a great honor to be able to develop databases and to build ship schedules and to build the tools that effectively manage tourism in a sustainable way. And we've done that, and I hope that continues to the future. And Jan, if I have one regret, before you and I left, I wish we could. I would have given you the IATA database to integrate into yours because we had it. We still have it, but anyway,
well,
we still may do that. But anyway, thank you again.
Thank you, Denise. Let me proceed to Dr. Timothy McCoy, who has some experience with Antarctica, in fact, on meteorites. I'll let him discuss more about that.
Tim? Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. I confess I feel a little like a fish out of water with this alphabet soup of acronyms of the Antarctic community. I work on a relatively small program. I manage the Smithsonian's portion of the U.S. Antarctic Meteorite Program, which is a collaborative venture between NASA, the National Science Foundation, and the Smithsonian to collect, curate, and distribute Antarctic meteorites. And so when I thought about international cooperation, I guess I've never really thought about international cooperation because it's just so inherent to what we do. Antarctica is the greatest catchment basin of meteorites in the world. We've collected more meteorites from that 10% of the Earth than from the rest of the Earth put together. And our program started in 1976 as a joint venture with the Japanese, who began collecting meteorites in 1969, a pivotal year for planetary science with the lunar landings. And we've kind of come full circle on that because now we have new programs, the Chinese program, the South Korean program for Antarctic meteorites, that are coming to us. We're taking the head of the Chinese expedition with us this year for collecting meteorites. But I think from a policy perspective, what Antarctic meteorites do is they pose actually a different form. So I brought one rock. It would be a shame if you came all the way here and didn't see one of our 130 million objects. And if you know the name of only one rock, it's probably this one. This is Allen Hills 84001. This is the Life on Mars meteorite. And this is the piece that was actually at the original press conference when that finding was announced in 1996. Very controversial to this day. Both sides are deeply embedded in their beliefs. But it's posed a tremendous challenge for us because when we think about other international spaces, this rock basically reinvigorated the Mars program. So we now have active Mars exploration programs from the U.S., from the European Space Agency, from the British, and instruments from one nation flying on all of those others. And so we have a number of legal challenges, which you'll hear about more tomorrow, but also a lot of logistical challenges on how do you actually manage a program like that. And I think while nothing fosters international scientific collaboration in international space like actually working together, but you also have to overcome those obstacles. And I could talk more about those if anyone's interested, but I think we're starting to see where the scientific community and perhaps even the legal community is coming to some agreement, but individual governments are putting up logistical barriers to us working together in terms of things like technology exchange. And unlike what Dr. Kennicott said, in planetary exploration, technology and science advancement go hand in hand. You cannot separate those. And so if you put up a barrier to one, you prevent the other. So glad to be here.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we have heard the speakers. I must congratulate all of them for a very interesting expedition in each of the areas assigned to them. This session is about international collaboration. In fact, how should we promote a larger audience for Antarctica? We have heard that with the 12 founding members and increasing up to 47 additional members that represent 65% of the world population, but still, as I think Paul mentioned yesterday, it still constitutes only about 25% of the countries of the world. So the question is, how could we promote more involvement of people all around? I'm sometimes thinking about, say, the people in Bangladesh or the Philippines who are more prone to the impact of global warming, for instance. How could they be involved in Antarctica when we know very well that the investment is tremendous? So with that background and the intervention of the speakers, let me invite the audience to pose question or observation to our distinguished panelists and speakers. Time-wise, since there's a gala dinner tonight, I intend to close the discussion by 5:25 this afternoon. All right. Please, it would help if you could identify yourself too.
My name is Galitsyn, and I have questions to Dr. Huber and then also to Mr. Cohen. Well, you mentioned the question of inspection and that not many countries participate in undertaking these inspections. Well, inspections were inserted in the treaty for particular reasons, to satisfy certain countries. It's the right. I don't think it's an obligation. So those countries who are interested in having inspection, they do exercise it. Those who are not, actually, it's not their obligation. So I think I would appreciate if you clarify, why do you think that every party to the treaty should actually undertake inspection in Antarctica? My second question to you is that there was a strong reluctance to have a permanent secretariat for many years. And the reason for that was that once you establish it, it will start mushrooming, creating more and more bureaucracy. You said that you would like to have standing committees. Actually, the Antarctic Treaty parties at some point had one meeting every 2 years, and they were quite satisfied with that because the major work is being done by scientists, not by politicians. So why do you think that standing committees would significantly improve actually what's happening in Antarctica? And I have a question to Mr. Cohen. I noticed, and I would apologize for raising this question, but this is like my previous incarnation when I worked for Antarctica. Your presentation is entitled Public Participation in Antarctica, Role of NGOs. But in your presentation, you frequently refer to NGOs and IGOs. When I worked for Antarctica, IUCN was NGO. When I moved to the UN Secretariat, IUCN changed its color and said, no, we are IGO. So when you provide advice in Antarctica, you will act as NGO or IGO?
Thank you. Okay. Anyone can start, please.
Yeah, okay. I think Mr. Golitsyn, in his questions, illustrated exactly the attitude of the ATCM. I don't see why a secretariat inevitably, automatically, I don't see any law of nature saying that a secretariat should always become an ungovernable bureaucracy. I think it depends very much on the ability of the ATCM itself to become more proactive in its administration of Antarctica, rather than confining itself to coming together once a year and negotiating new agreements without actually taking much interest in what happens to these agreements after they have been agreed. So now, as to the inspections, well, yes, it is true that it's not a mandatory requirement to do that. I believe myself that as the inspection mechanism is one of the essential elements of the governance of Antarctica, that a country joining the treaty and then making efforts to become a consultative party, that it is a bit strange if they never carry out any inspections, because it is certainly a moral obligation if you are in the treaty system. The ATCM has always been against secretariat standing committees. But then why set up a secretariat and say in every third sentence that the secretariat has to work under the supervision of the ATCM if there is nobody to supervise, actually? I can tell you from my personal experience that this was an extremely frustrating facet of this organization.
Okay. Question for IUCN.
Thank you. And I had cut my talk. I would have addressed that with more time, but let me do it now. When IUCN delegation provides advice in an Antarctic Treaty consultative meeting, it does it as an international organization having a scientific or technical interest in Antarctica. IUCN itself is a complicated body because we have both government and non-government members, so we are both intergovernmental and non-governmental. We also have six commissions with people who volunteer and who are not IUCN secretariat, and so that makes it even more complex. We often, there are persons who are members of commissions who are also serving on national delegations. This was one of the things I was going to say is, of course, and I alluded to it, non-governmental organizations provide advice to the ATCM as experts and as observers, because some observers are non-governmental. I believe some are intergovernmental. Some experts are non-governmental, some are intergovernmental. But non-governmental organizations also have an opportunity to provide advice through national delegations. Many national delegations choose to seek advice from a range of interested domestic constituencies. So those are two different ways that can be done. One other point I will jump in here I was going to make is, and this refers to something from an earlier panel, I think it's very important that scientific advice and the best scientific advice be provided to policymakers, and that's something that I see very much as a role for IUCN and other non-governmental and other intergovernmental organizations. And, you know, speaking for myself, I do look to see the most relevant and pertinent and up-to-date science that I can find in journals, and the SCAR report would be one example, that I could then bring to meetings, in the case of meetings I tend to go to at the UN, but also could be meetings at Antarctic, of Antarctic, under the Antarctic Treaty system. Let me put it that way. So, thank you.
Thank you. More questions? Marie? Who's first? All right. Please.
Thank you. I would like to follow up the exchange of views between you, Mr. Huber, and Judge Golitsyn. You indicated that you would have preferred that the Antarctic Treaty Consultative Meeting takes over some, let's say, function as far as implementation is concerned. I don't share your views on that. Not even the European community administers, so to speak. And that is why political scientists have developed this notion of multi-level system. There's a distribution of function between one level, developing rules, the legislative power, and the other one is doing the implementation. Not even the UN does management. And for that reason, expecting the Antarctic Treaty Consultative Meeting to do administration or management is, I believe, asking for too much. Secondly, let me put it this way. The very carefully drafted function of the Secretariat, and it took many years to even agree on these rules, is also reflecting Article 4 of the Antarctic Treaty. Let's face that. And it has been said yesterday, and will be said tomorrow again, that this is establishing a very, very delicate balance, which the Antarctic Treaty Consultative Meeting did not want to touch. Finally, as far as inspections are concerned, we have many other regimes with inspections. There was a spillover from the Antarctic Treaty system to, let's say, a couple of arms restrictions where we have inspections. It's not an obligation. It's a right. And the fact that there is a right is in itself already a guarantee. And therefore, if states don't inspect, they just don't see the need, they trust, and that's a good view. I'm coming from the universities. In the moment we have in Europe the tendency to be inspected, assessed, we call it, every second month. You cannot believe how much that takes off from our academic or scientific efforts. But that's a side of a remark beyond the point. Thank you.
Thank you, David. And then Marie.
This is a question for Jan on the management of the Secretariat. We've heard earlier how important it is to think about introducing a wider range of countries to become members, active members of the treaty. We have 47 at the moment. And yet we're deficient in many areas. There's only one African country a member. There's no Middle Eastern countries a members and so on. Now, if we accept that that is a good idea and we want to increase the number of countries, let's say to 60, the Secretariat is already governed by a management board of 29 countries, which is an absolutely ludicrous situation in terms of governing an activity. Boards of 29 don't function well. They, by default, usually take a position which is not helpful. So if it's 60 people forming the board, it's even more unmanageable as a governance structure. So let me suggest an idea to Jan, and that is that the treaty parties ought to manage the Secretariat through an elected executive who actually have the responsibility to discharge the management of the Secretariat on a continuing basis. And the governance body is not then formed of 29 or 60, but maybe of 8 or 9 countries elected from amongst the consultative parties.
Thank you. Marie, your question is on management too? All right.
I have one on management, and then I have one to Mr. Retamales as well.
All right.
Now, first I'd like to make a comment on the inspection. I mean, I agree with Judge Golitsyn and Judge Wolfram that, of course, it is mandatory, but we should also remember that there are two types of inspection, the original inspection, and then you have the inspection under the environmental protocol. And I think that what, if I understand it correctly, Mr. Huber is trying to convey is that states parties to these treaties do have a responsibility to actively engage in at least the environmental protection, which is a totally different type of inspection regime than the original, because it is a procedure and you communicate with the ones that you have inspected or are about to inspect. My concern is something else, and it's something that Mr. Huber said, which I wasn't aware of, and it's the really horrendous decline in respecting the rules that the treaty parties themselves have set up. Because if it is the case, as you say, that the number of measures and that need now to be, accepted, are going down, then it is really a bad signal to the external world, the state parties and the international community, that the treaty parties are not taking their own regulations seriously. And what kind of message does that send? I mean, it's always been bad. It's always been a slow process. Admittedly, it has. But at least there was an attempt in the mid-80s and the 90s to speed it up. And I think that this is, it's not a challenge as long as it works, and you say it works anyway. But it is certainly a challenge if the situation, the ATS, is facing a new type of crisis, because the criticism will be directly, that you're not even following your own measures and recommendations. And I think that is really, really serious. And something I think that the treaty parties need to address on a more serious matter, particularly since, in effect, we require non-consultative parties that want to become consultative to accept all the recommendations. That's some sort of a understanding. My question to Mr. Retamales to conclude was that I found your presentation very, very interesting. I don't know if I interpreted you correctly, so please enlighten me. But I got a very strong feeling that you were conveying a message that the logistics support is scarce, and all states have to share it in one way or another. And that sort of raises the question of how do you decide to which science, what kind of science program will have these logistics? And are there, what about the international cooperation in that respect? Thank you.
Thank you. Jan, and then Jose. Jan first.
Yes. Well, I see that on the most controversial thing I said apparently concerned the inspections. I'm very grateful for Marie for pointing out that indeed there is inspections have now a greater range and a wider dimension than they originally had. Indeed, now, if you read the reports of the inspections, they concern the great majority of them is taken up by environmental concerns. Now, on the question of management, I think I did not have enough time to explain my my views on that. It is definitely, and I completely agree with Judge Wolfram on this, it is definitely not a good idea to replace the national implementation and execution of the measures of the ATCM by some kind of international mechanism. What I'm suggesting is that the parties are not taking their national responsibility seriously enough, in the sense that the environment that they now have to administer is much more complicated with many more actors, and to rely on the old model of, okay, I'll keep my expedition in order and that's it, that is not enough. And so that parties should coordinate and liaise much more intensively and should make arrangements so that all areas of Antarctica are covered, and that they should make use of the means provided by the information exchange system. Now, if a ship appears over the horizon and the station commander looks at that, he doesn't know if that ship has a license or not from whatever party. B, he is not usually specifically tasked to even check this or to see, you know, what the ship is doing or to report on if anything should happen. In practice, of course, this is an area where I defer to much greater knowledge here on my left, but from anecdotal evidence, it suggests that when ships or any kind of, you know, when you travel around Antarctica, you encounter very different interpretations of the tasks that each expedition seems to think they have. And so that is the sort of situation where the ATCM should take an interest in and should try to improve by closer cooperation. Not that it should become itself the governing body.
Thank you.
That's what I would say on that. That's, I think.
All right. Jose?
International cooperation is not easy. We were talking before about having four different official languages in the treaty. But in COMNAP, I think we have 18 or 19 different languages. So Michael Lang was referring before to the task of training appropriate the personnel and the scientists and the logistics that go to Antarctica. But training is performed in different ways in different countries. The decision-making process for which science is going to be conducted in Antarctica is also made separately in every country. So to have international cooperation is not easy. It's important, and we have seen some very important examples in the last few years, especially with the International Polar Year, but also from the very beginning of the system 20 years ago or there has been cooperation for a long time. But I would say that trying to answer your question, that still a couple of more things could be done that would increase cooperation and would perhaps bring science and policy interactions, so to bring. I mean, we are a little bit in the middle of the sandwich. The managers, we get the advice from the treaty on what the policies are, and we know the needs and what the scientists would like to do. We have to implement to try to work with those. But the way it is run, the business, makes sometimes difficult to have cooperation organized in a global way, say. There is always cooperation party to party, of course, and sometimes three or four parties that are working in an area. But say, it's not easy, but the European Union is perhaps in a privileged position to have call for proposals where several countries could participate, or why not other areas of the world could also do the same. There has been some examples recently which perhaps will come in this direction in a couple of countries. Because the way that science is decided in most part of the world is by peer review system, presenting proposals to a call for proposals, then if every country has a separate call for proposals, when do you know which projects are similar or which project could be complementary? I mean, it's COMNAP is one fora where we can know that, and we're still developing tools for that. But if we would have, say, 15 European countries working in Antarctica every year, I know that there has been some work towards that, and but it's not easy. I mean, it's so there is a lot that can be done. I think it can be done better. It doesn't make sense. Say the treaty says that. Avoid duplication of efforts, to have less environmental footprint. That means we should have a look every year at what scientific projects have been duplicated, perhaps, and see what we can do about it and how we can make things better.
Okay.
The information is in the system and it can be used.
Okay. Let's stay along this line of reasoning. I had a question to Carl, because you have provided us a very impressive list of example of international cooperation right from the word go, when the Russian and the American were doing the expedition in the Weddell Sea. And you listed a number of examples, and also the incremental number of multinational research papers. At the outset, I pose a question. How do you expand international collaboration within the treaty members and beyond? Carl and Jose may want to respond to this too, and also Helen, please.
Yeah, I've been actually thinking about your opening question for several minutes now, and recognizing that this issue of broadening the participation in Antarctic activities partly involves governance, partly involving, and I think that's what we've mostly been discussing up until now, is governance, mechanisms for governance, mechanisms for managing treaty affairs. The other side, of course, is broadening collaborations, international collaborations, participation in the research, whether it's environmental research, physical science research, life science, whatever. I think I wanted to point out at least two factors on the latter, the second issue, the scientific collaboration. One is that the treaty very wisely requires that we share our data. You actually don't have to go to Antarctica and get on an airplane to collaborate and to perhaps write a paper that changes the world in some way. So, but there is a challenge there. The Both COMNAP and SCAR have been supporting a process to make sure metadata, at least, are available so that scientists from other countries will know where to find the data. But finding the data and actually accessing it is difficult. So that's a challenge that I don't think we've addressed effectively. But at least the tool is there for broadening collaboration. Now, collaborations, I think it's fair to say, especially nowadays, start out almost entirely on a scientist-to-scientist basis. They don't start out with Jose and Carl sitting down and saying, you know, let's get together and do something. We say, let's find out what our science communities are interested in doing as collaborators. And then we see what it takes to assist them. And that process is not restricted in any way to the treaty parties. If you look at the participants in international polar year activity, you'll find out that it extended much beyond the signatories to the treaty. The second comment I wanted to make on that line is that now I'm not from the space agency, but the space agencies make their data. So the data comes down a pipe, so to speak, an electronic pipe from satellites, and it's there, it's calibrated, it's there for any scientist or group of scientists to use. I think there's an awareness issue that we ought to be working harder on to make other scientists who aren't involved in Antarctic research aware that there's a rich source of data from ESA, from NASA, from Japanese Space Agency, Indian Space Agency. Now, it's true that treaty adherents have that requirement to make data available, and perhaps countries with space agencies that don't belong to the treaty don't follow those. I don't know. That's a subtlety we ought to look into. But I think the International Polar Year, together with the treaty organization, has built an international science community that doesn't necessarily care too much whether their country is involved in governing the continent. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's not the way it should be. Maybe if they cared more about it, we'd address these issues more effectively.
Wow.
So in sum, I think things have changed since the treaty was formulated in some ways. To some extent, when we think about governance, we're still thinking about presence, feet on the ground. But instrumentation has developed in such a way that some of the most important science is done now without actually being present in Antarctica. Mm-hmm. So if we build on that, we ought to be able to broaden our colleagues.
Yeah. Thank you. Harlan, on that count, or something else? I want to ask Timothy, what's your take on this, since space was mentioned, maybe...
Well, yeah. It's an excellent point. You know, all of the spacecraft missions now, the data comes down and goes instantly out to the system. That's uncalibrated data, and then within 90 to 180 days, usually you have to release the calibrated data. But I think one of the things you see, and if you really want to encourage international collaboration, is make available funds, pooled funds, to do activities that you wouldn't be able to do as a single nation. And I think when it comes to releasing data, you know, you have to step back a little bit and say, if you want to move that direction, you're going to have to put some serious resources into something like NASA has, like the Planetary Data System, and realize that that may cost you some short-term exploration in order to foster long-term science, which has been extremely beneficial in the NASA realm. But as I say, you have to make that short-term sacrifice, which is oftentimes very difficult to do.
Thank you.
I was going to say, as a conservation organization, we certainly want to see the footprint kept as small as possible and therefore welcome any work that can be done remotely or through cooperation with those who are already there. This brings up the requirement that scientific observations and results from Antarctica shall be exchanged and made freely available. And I think this is a very important point, that such data observations and results should be freely available, which then brings a reference to an earlier panel that mentioned patenting. And I think patenting is a very dangerous way to go with respect of Antarctic genetic material, because it restricts the free availability. It encourages more feet on the ground, and it also would have implications for the Article 4 of the treaty. I had one quick observation on the issue of measures. I believe, and I may be wrong, that since Recommendation 1610 that incorporated Annex 5 of the Protocol entered into force, many measures, those that include management plans for protected areas, work under a tacit approval system. And so perhaps those are considered in force. I don't know. It would be interesting to know what percentage of measures, since I think that was 1998, are management plans.
All right. Jan, very quickly.
Very quickly. Harlan is, of course, completely correct. The largest category of measures adopted nowadays, those relating to protected areas, almost always fall under the automatic entry into force procedures. And so the absolute number of measures that has to be dealt with has been dropping in recent years because of that important category. Nevertheless, as I said, there are still measures from Rio de Janeiro from 1987 waiting to go into effect.
Thank you. We still have a few more minutes. Can we have some reaction to Denise's comments on tourism? Tourism. All right. Okay, yourself and the gentleman up here. You go ahead, the lady.
Well, I guess my question in regards to tourism is there's a lot of discussion about the incorporation or the possible incorporation of NGOs and IGOs and the other governmental actors, and I'm wondering when we're talking about non-traditional ways of doing, you know, moving beyond the way the Antarctic Treaty was set up in an earlier time, and that we live maybe perhaps in a different world. I'm wondering what are the possibilities of inviting in as well as observers and other things, but private entities as well. And the first thing that comes to my mind is the tourism operator, the tourist operators, and the collaboration that could exist in that.
Right.
And maybe it already does, and that's one thing that I don't know.
Thank you. Please. Yeah.
Do you want me to answer?
Thank you. Tom Ritchie. First of all, Dr. Cohen, IATO stands for International Association of Antarctic Tour Operators. I'm very fortunate to have spent the last 33 years both as a field scientist and leading tours to Antarctica. And I was here with Denise Landau when we wrote up the bylaws for IATO. And I wanted to follow up with the young lady, Kate Harris, this morning with her essay subject. We competing travel companies were inspired by the Antarctic Treaty, and we got together and formed IATO and wrote up bylaws, put a lot of thought and effort into it, because we're also scared by tourism. You know, I've heard tourism mentioned numerous times in the last couple of days, and it always goes along with the word threat or challenge or problem. And we've been very concerned about that. Our bylaws were incorporated virtually word for word into Recommendation 18-1, Guidance for Visitors to the Antarctic. So I just thought that was an important comment to make on how important the Antarctic Treaty has been to us. And it has been very successful. Our IATO has been very successful thus far. We're at a crisis right now that Denise mentioned regarding large cruise ship companies that want to get in on the act, and we've resisted them for a long time, but they're very powerful, and there are pros and cons because we would like to control them to make sure environmental protocol is followed and safety aspects are looked after. And so that's one point I'd like to bring up and see how people feel about that. We have lots of politicians and lawyers and scientists here. You know, people on a large cruise ship have a smaller personal imprint, but also we feel that a lot of those ships have no business being down in ice conditions, so, you know, there are pros and cons.
All right. I'll let Denise respond to that. We may not have any more time. Denise.
Thank you. I'll respond to your question back there first. IATO which is the International Association of Antarctica Tour Operators, is an expert group to the ATCM. So we've been participating since 1992 at every ATCM, provide papers, have discussions, participate in a lot of the international contact groups and the working groups within the ATCM family, if you want to call it that. So it's an organization that's very much integrated into the system as a whole. And having been around for a little bit, when I go back to even the first ATCM meeting that I went to in 1997, I could only attend part of the meeting. Expert groups and observers were actually asked to leave certain sessions of the meeting. And what's evolved now over the last 14 years is that we're actually invited to the whole of the meeting for the most part, which is a huge change, and it just shows a plus in terms of the movement towards international cooperation. And also the participation in the intersessional contract groups is changed. The other thing that's happened within the ATCM family, and I'm saying family because I'm not sure what other word to use, but back in the early 90s, there wasn't really much cooperation, or even IATO didn't really talk to COMNAP or SCAR or anybody else. It just sort of was this organization that lived on its own. But I remember we had a meeting, and there was a few of us that sat around a table in New York in 1995, and that was the first real sort of COMNAP-IATO interaction. And since then, there is very regular COMNAP-SCAR ASOC interaction between all of these groups within the Antarctic Treaty System, including the HCA, the Hydrographic Committee of Antarctica. So that's expanded. So I think hopefully that answers your question.
Thank you, Denise. Michael, since we are in the Smithsonian, you have the last question.
Like that, we see the effects of many, many tourists and many big ships coming in. There has to be some carrying capacity for the peninsula, for example. And as was just pointed out, some ships should just not be there, as recent examples have shown. So what's the enforcement policy, or is there one? And second is, why should countries such as Argentina and Chile, for example, be saddled with search and rescue missions and the resources that go into that for vessels and mishaps that shouldn't occur in the first place?
30-second answer from anyone here?
Yeah. Actually, the question of the big ships is really interesting because it ties together two themes that have been here, and that is the ATCM has already adopted a measure to regulate ships and to say that ships shouldn't go there unless there are adequate search and rescue arrangements. That measure was adopted in 2004, Measure 1, 2004. Up to now, only 7 countries have approved it. This is going to take a long, long time, but it relates to my concern about the seriousness with which the parties regard their governance tasks.
All right. Thank you very much. I think we have run out of time. We may want to continue during the dinner tonight. Let me just thank all the speakers and panelists for a very exciting session and inputs from the audience. Thank you very much.